You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Tim Durfee. Tim, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tim, let's talk about what you're working on now. How do you identify yourself in all that you're doing? And to begin with, you know, as a designer and an artist, but also how what projects or what is currently occupying your thinking or working time?
Yeah, well, the question how do I define myself is always one that causes a bit of anxiety because it's so much almost become part of what my work is somehow trying to define my way to that definition. But yeah, in the work I'm doing now, that might actually give a bit of a profile of some of that work. There are a number of things going on. I have some residential work. I'm trained as an architect, and that's sort of still the kind of central work that we do in my studio. I have some small furniture projects that have been ongoing. A large public artwork that's still in the process of going through its final development with the city. That's for the Northeast Police Station for the LAPD. Large exterior work there. And I just finished curating a show that was at, or was actually still at, the Shenzhen Biennial of Architecture and Urbanism in China, co-curated with Mimi Zeiger. And then lastly, I have a piece that was also a collaboration and in that same show, but it's sort of an ongoing piece, which is basically a film, sort of a media piece that is about the city, and it's called Everything on Time. So it's sort of a range of things.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about all of them then in a different order, but let's talk about the public work that's happening at the LAPD. What exactly is that, and how did that come to be?
Yeah. So a collaborator, Arisana Rain, who's also a designer, we were shortlisted for proposing work for this this commission. It's actually coordinated through the Department of Cultural Affairs in Los Angeles. And then we were awarded the commission, and it's for this police station, actually the most active of the LAPD stations, very much in need of a new station. Large division that encompasses most of Northeast Los Angeles, and it's funny because it's in the area where I live, so I'm very familiar with the site. And the proposal is a large steel structure. The current version of it is about 25 feet tall, and it's called Rays. It sort of evokes the famous motif on the LAPD badge that we all remember from television, I guess, of those radiating lines coming from behind the city hall on the badge.
Oh, right. I didn't think of it when you said that, but now, yeah.
And, you know, for this public work, you have to find a hook that is going to be comprehensible to the general audience, and I think that's appropriate, I suppose.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but how big is the whole piece? What's the scope we're talking about?
Yeah, so, well, the original version of it actually was to be suspended from the entrance area, and I could talk more about that, but it's now in a different version, so I won't go into it too much. But in that iteration, it would sit within a 16-foot cube, so it was 16 feet tall and wide and deep. And it has this kind of woven pattern of these lines that sort of bend back on themselves. And that figure now has been reoriented to stand on the ground as you drive by on San Fernando Road. The motif of these rays is sort of evoked, but you could see it as being also looking like the searchlights at night in LA, but that that could be an interpretation of what it is as well. So there's a kind of a double meaning there, I think, which seems appropriate. It's sort of, you know, LA is almost equally famous for its dazzling sunsets as it is for the sort of spectacle at night.
Right. That was the association that came to mind for me, like kind of rays of light, rays of hope, you know. I don't know what the designer meant initially on that badge, but I would think it's kind of a something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly it has a bit of a kind of social realist sort of a feel to it in the original badge design. And
right.
And indeed, it was meant to sort of represent the sort of West Coast setting of L.A., And there is a lot of that kind of imagery we're trying to sort of bring back. It's a bit optimistic in that respect. But it's also, it's trying to sort of evoke both sides of that, both ideas of rays.
And so now in its final iteration, it's freestanding, it's in front of the station, and it's kind of a large cube. Is that the case?
Well, it's not a cube. I just was sort of using that as a way of describing the scale of it. It's about 12 feet wide and about 15 or 16 feet deep. And it's kind of hard to describe. It sort of stands upright. It's based upon the form, and there are these lines. I think of it as very calligraphic. It's as though, and actually, the line could be drawn as one continuous line if you were to trace it with your finger. And it creates this sort of figure against the sky. And it's very, very light. And the strength of it comes from the pattern of the geometry. So the lines are actually tracing the surface of a cone, which creates this very strong structural shape, this sort of cone shell form that is very rigid. So it has a kind of structural concept, if you will, as well, which allows it to be very, very light in appearance, but actually quite strong. I don't know if that's helpful, but at some point I'll certainly share an image.
No, it's very interesting, and you know, if there are, we may have images on it on here or links to it, but that's that sounds like an exciting project, because also your audience is very unusual. It's all the police as well as all the people that they're bringing into the station see that,
yeah.
As right. That's
No, actually, that I have to say, it's a very exciting dimension of this kind of a commission, because it will be very visible, and to all people, you know, coming by, and as well as the officers included, and it's been really interesting to work with that client, and a demanding in a way that is not necessarily familiar to us, but that's
absolutely
an interesting process, yeah.
I like that. And let's talk about the show you curated. And you said that was in the Shenzhen Biennial. Is that where that was?
That's right, yeah. And it's a show that is very small. It actually was comprised entirely of six video works by different architects and designers. And the show was called Now There, and the sort of subtitle is Scenes from the Post-Geographic City. And, just brief description is I would lead off by sort of describing a bit of the context. The larger biennial exhibition this year was sort of running along the theme of it was called Reliving the City, and it was sort of looking at different ways in which perhaps we can rethink how to inhabit cities of today. With all sorts of agendas flying around, and it's an interesting setup. But one of our primary sort of approaches to this was to question what a city is, really, because indeed, you know, today we're so invested on our various other platforms of community, you know, social networks and other forms of non-geographically defined community. We were just trying to sort of ask that very simple question, you know, maybe a city really isn't just that geographically determined aggregation of physical buildings, but if we open it up a little bit more, what do we have? And so that's sort of one central idea. And then another idea, I would say, is more about tone and our position as exhibitors in this show. There were a lot of things we didn't want to be. We didn't want to present some sort of perhaps overly earnest set of proposals about what the future city would be on one hand. We also were becoming less interested in this kind of sort of leaden dystopic visions of the future that are now so prevalent. And so we tried to sort of adopt a kind of, for lack of a better word, a kind of sense of humor about it and open up really quite different ways of tackling or approaching this kind of generic sort of topic. So it was really fun to work on. And actually, one other component to the six video works was kind of a small publication that Minnie Zeiger and I assembled with the contributions of some other writers. And so it kind of together made a sort of small work. We kind of described it as a visual essay as opposed to a proper exhibition. You know, it kind of had a sort of modesty to it. But we were really pleased with the way in which people reacted to it. It was kind of, I think, seen as, I think people got it, that is to say. You know, so there was a lot of information in the show, a lot of really great work. And then ours was sort of sat there with this kind of, I'll say it kind of had a modest presence in the space, but people would spend time with it, and I think really happy with how that came out.
And you said you had a film in that particular show, or was that somewhere else?
Well, yes. So it's in that show, and it's an ongoing project. And that film was called Everything on Time, and it was produced with my collaborator Ben Hooker and actually a recent thesis graduate of ours, Jenny Rodenhouse. Yeah, and I'll describe that piece a little bit. It has five sort of sections to it. Each section takes on a different scenario of a possible kind of near future city. And I really want to sort of emphasize how hesitant I am to use words like future city together, because it evokes such strong imagery for everyone hearing it, myself included, of a kind of, you know, either a very shiny corporate image of a perfect utopian city, or the kind of grungy dystopic sort of visions that we're so familiar with. And what we really, really worked hard to do was to kind of create a kind of a tone that resists those kinds of stereotypes, and rather just allows people to sort of just drop into a kind of speculative space. It's very hard to describe. It's funny. I always feel awkward describing it because I'm always trying to sort of talk about what it's not. But regardless, so these five different sections each are sort of extrapolations of for lack of a better word, trends, if you will, that are sort of happening now, and they also take their title from those, and then are built.
But trends in architecture and in cities, or what?
Yeah, you know,
like visually, kind of, what are we seeing?
Right. So, so I'll describe a few of them, and that'll sort of answer your question. One of them, one of the pieces is called the Logistical Baroque, and it's taking the kind of phenomenon of Uber, of course, and the sharing economy and stuff that we're all hearing about and experiencing, and just turns it like all the way up. at least that's how we were thinking of doing it. So that it's as though everything in the city is in motion, in on its way to being borrowed by somebody else. It's a little bit over the top, but we were really excited about just kind of playing it out this very simple idea. So it's almost like making a a world, if you will, with that one rule that everything, nothing is fixed exactly, and it's always kind of on its way. And it's sort of it's non-narrative. It's a little bit, there's a little bit of humor to it. We have sounds of a marching band in the background and all the things mixed in. But it's really meant to sort of kind of provoke a reflection on this phenomenon. And also, as, you know, designers and architects and artists and people that are interested in not just the sort of technological and economic dimensions of this, but also in culture, you know, it's also trying to sort of fast forward into to imagining how that might change our definition of urban dwelling or whatever it is. Sounds a little bit pretentious to describe it that way, but and then another one, another of the five is called Freak Zones. So it's a riff on Free Zone. So probably the most famous Free Zone is Shenzhen itself. You know, these kind of areas of economic exception, you know, that sort of operate without the prevailing laws of its host country, and in order to facilitate global trade and so on. And this is a phenomenon that's happening all over the world. There are free zones in the U.S. and free zones all over Asia and so on. And just a brief description of this is that we kind of took that phenomenon and then added it to another thing that we were noticing, which is something of occurring, I guess, starting pretty much last year, was sort of the announcement that for the first time, you know, these kind of YouTube superstars were actually making real money, right? So the first YouTube millionaires started to emerge. And so we kind of, almost as a lark, we kind of imagined, what if they became our new industrial barons, these people whose fame has emerged from, you know, recording how-to videos in their suburban bedrooms or whatever. And so this kind of strange kind of formula emerged of a kind of city that emerged through this very ephemeral form of fame. It's an odd setup, but it kind of, it was really fun and I think productive to frame such a strange premise for a city and therefore, of course, for design or whatever it is that we're doing.
Yeah. That sounds really interesting. I'm trying to interrupt, but the free zone that you were mentioning before,
Yeah. Can
you define that again? What does that exactly mean, a free zone that you were saying is all around the world in different places, in the U.S.
Sure.
And everywhere?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I don't know the precise history, but I do know that some of the earliest ones were in PRC, in the People's Republic of China, and Shenzhen was indeed one of the first. And, you know, so here they were, a communist country that was starting to open up commercially to the world, you know, in terms of trade and so on. And the only way they could really pull that off was to allow certain areas, and of course Shenzhen being just next to Hong Kong on the mainland, was a perfect location to have a port and all sorts of kind of commerce like that happening. They would sort of define those areas as being exempt from the issues of tax and regulation that would constrain that kind of free trade in other areas. And it sounds like, funny, it sounds like a very technical or wonky kind of premise to start with, but from an urban perspective, it's such a strange idea, you know. Actually, it's funny, this fall I took a bunch of students out to the Moreno Valley in California, and there's one of the world's largest buildings there. It was recently built, and they're building another one of them. It's a massive logistics center. So it's a place where packages come in, and these robots sort them, you know, and scan them and send them back out. And huge place, half a mile wide by over half a mile long. And but that building is a free zone. So if you're inside the building, and you, let's say, broke the law somehow, it would be the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security and not the local jurisdiction of that county. And it's done that way in order for to just facilitate the trade essentially that's happening there. You know, these packages come in, these units of materials and so on, literally just come in on a truck from the port of LA or Long Beach, and you know, by law, the interiors of those trucks are not in the U.S. And then it goes inside this logistics center, gets sorted around, still in this bubble, not literally existing, not legally existing in the U.S., and then only becomes only enters the country when it's loaded onto a truck. Now, I just want to say the thing that specifically attracts me to this idea, the theorist and historian Keller Easterling has written extensively about this idea. She's at Yale, actually. But specifically is just how strenuous, from a legal standpoint, these kinds of almost gerrymandering, they're almost like economic gerrymandering, right? The sort of weird shapes that would emerge if you were to draw the border of the free zone to the real U.S. in the case of that logistics center. And that really supports this idea of the sort of post-geographic city, you know, the fact that, in the case of that logistics center in the Moreno Valley, from a legal standpoint, it doesn't exist there, you know. And yet, of course, geographically it does and so on. So which is
right.
More important in a way, you know.
Fascinating. It sounds like a great show, and the reaction to the show so far has been good, you say, right? There's been good reaction.
Yeah, I think so. And, it's funny. I think it's because if there's one area where we're really working hard, it's to try not to just do what we're seeing everyone else doing. And clearly there are a lot of issues that are urgent out there in the realm of architecture, to be sure. But we do find, an opening, which is to try to provoke an authentic cross-disciplinary conversation. You know, I mean, there's plenty of sort of TED Talk-ish kind of discussions about interdisciplinarity and so on, but we're just trying to, and we're not sort of pretending to entirely know what we're talking about, but we are doing earnest research to sort of make sure that we have framed all of our premises, you know, kind of properly, if you will. But I think it's been interesting to have people figure out how to talk about it, and that alone, I feel, has been worthwhile.
And lastly, before we go, can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing in terms of your, which is kind of the third element of all the things that you're doing? I mean, as actually, then there's also your teaching, but maybe we should end up by talking about something that's happening in your architectural practice, in your day job, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I think the thing. So these projects going on, but in terms of where, if you will, the action is in terms of my thinking about this work is trying to build a bridge from real built work back to this other stuff I've been talking about in a way that is real, you know. So, and it's tricky because, you know, indeed, physical architecture is just loaded with constraints, financial and practical and material and so on. And it's an interesting challenge to try to find an opening to build a connection. So one of the projects is a house in Northeast Los Angeles. It has a number of elements to it that have more of a connection to this kind of question of geography that I sort of was discussing in the earlier project. But I, you know, I'll just give one example of something that's in the piece where the roofing material. So, for example, it's this large sort of wedge of a building. Not that large, really. Actually, large on the site, but not really all that large. But and it sort of forms a kind of bookend to the site. And this is, the roof kind of comes down all the way to the ground, and it's clad in metal roofing material. And I started working with this kind of pixelation, and this is a collaboration with Arizona Rain, the designer I mentioned earlier. But the pixelation, the choice of it, sort of these different colors that are used for the material on the roof, you know, and it's a modest budget. It's not as though it's this project that we could do anything we wanted. But it was interesting to explore the idea of transparency in the context of some of this other work. And so you have this large roof that comes to the ground, but rather than treating it as an opaque surface that can then be punctuated with windows, or, you know, sort of basic formal process that one might engage in, we tried to imagine it being kind of virtually transparent. So what I mean by that is we photographed what was behind the building and then introduced a kind of pixelized version of it and then used that as the pattern that that was reproduced in the metal panels. Simple idea, and perhaps maybe even a one-liner of an idea, but I'm excited even in the modesty of just the process of thinking about a different rationale for choosing materials, you know, not based upon the kind of traditional dialogue that materials and structure are intended to have on one hand, and on the other hand, not kind of getting too fetishistic with the kind of computational influences that we've seen, you know, and Frank Gehry is the most famous example, but others who have really indulged in a kind of form-driven architecture. But in almost in a dumbed-down way, which is perhaps more true to people's lived experience, which is a kind of, you know, which is the surface and which is the image, and you know, is the city what's in front of us, or is the city what we're simultaneously trafficking through on our phones or whatever. Anyway, small example of that, but that's sort of where a lot of the thinking is going right now. But yeah, so you know, a lot of these different balls in the air, but it's I enjoy, I have to say, jumping between things. It's just, yeah, that's just what I like.
I like that. Well, yeah, you kind of summed it up. How difficult it is to define exactly what you do. And before we go, is there I mean, now that we know these, at least part of three aspects of your practice, is there a future project that you're doing or looking forward to that's maybe in idea stage now, or anything else that's something we should be looking forward to of yours?
Yeah, well, there are a number I could talk about. I will, though, I think just build on the Everything on Time project because of how many projects seem to be coming out of that. So, you know, in that small piece, we, you know, we worked with actors and worked on putting sound and music together and lots of, you know, digital CG work and live action and all these other things kind of coming together. And it's just been so interesting. We keep kind of generating new projects out of that we're excited to sort of take on. And so, you know, I'm kind of, that's sort of the next thing I would say is finding what new life this can have. It's really interesting. You know, people say digital video, is that as though that means anything. But I will say that what is uniquely different about the video form residing as a or existing as a digital file is that with impunity, you can just layer onto it and add to it and remix it. You know, it makes zero difference And there's something so interesting about that authentic open-endedness. And so it's really been fun to work with. So anyway, I'm looking forward. I have another show coming up where that will be the sort of next version of that piece will be in there, and I hope to keep that going.
And where will that show be that's coming up?
At the Architecture and Design Museum in Los Angeles. And they're recently relocated to the Arts District in downtown, near SciArc downtown.
Very good. Well, I look forward to that, and hopefully some of our listeners can go there as well. Tim, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure. Likewise. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.